From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, cannibalism, promiscuity, and virgin birth. We talk about the strange and kinky sex lives of animals and bugs with evolutionary biologist Olivia Judson. In her new guidebook to the biology of sex, Judson writes in the persona of Dr. Tatiana, a sex columnist for Creatures Great and Small. As Dr. Tatiana gives these organisms advice, Judson provides readers with the biology behind their bizarre sexual practices. Also, pirates on the high seas. We talked to deep sea explorer Barry Clifford, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD featuring saxophonist Illinois Jacket. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The head of Florida's Department of Children and Families has resigned. Kathleen Kearney had been under fire for a number of months because of a number of problems in that agency. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
The final blow for Kathleen Kearney, the secretary of the Florida Department of Children and Families, came over the weekend. That's when the South Florida Sun Sentinel reported that its reporters had found, with not much difficulty, 9 foster children that the department said it could not locate. It was just the latest embarrassment for the department, which had reeled under disclosures that it suffered from sloppy record keeping, allowed children to stay unsupervised in motels, and most famously lost track of Relia Wilson, who has been missing for more than 15 months. While Kearney has long had the support of Florida Governor Jeb Bush, he said the latest revelations indicated that the department needed a new approach. Kearney submitted her resignation soon after. It will be effective September 3rd. A search is on to find a replacement. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Federal Reserve policymakers left a key interest rate unchanged today. However, the Fed shifted from a neutral stance toward the economy to one that signaled a readiness to cut short-term interest rates in coming months, but only if economic conditions worsen. Economist Ken Malin says today's decision shows admirable restraint on the part of policymakers.
The Fed did not do a knee-jerk sort of thing and really create a deeper hole that it might need to dig out of at some point down the road, for instance, in 2003.
Malin says that interest rate cuts should not be seen as a quick fix for a difficult economic situation. Secretary of State Colin Powell asked foreign governments today to help protect American peacekeepers from the reach of a new international war crimes court. However, Powell denied charges that the U.S. is bullying other countries into such agreements. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
When asked, Secretary Powell did not deny that the U.S. may withhold military funds and training, but he said the U.S. is, quote, not bludgeoning or threatening friends, but rather discussing with them its concerns about the International Criminal Court. The Bush administration has consistently opposed the court on the grounds that hostile nations might abuse it and bring politically motivated cases against Americans, especially U.S. peacekeepers abroad. Two countries, Romania and Israel, have signed deals pledging not to turn U.S. peacekeepers over to the international court. Under a new anti-terrorism law, Washington may suspend military aid to many other countries if they don't follow suit. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 206 points, finishing the day at 84.82 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq closed down 37 points, while the S&P 500 closed down 19 points. This is NPR News. Thousands of New York City police officers and firefighters are planning to rally in Times Square later this week to demand better pay. A union official said today the rally is scheduled for Thursday afternoon. They hope to publicize the city's ongoing dispute with the police union, as well as upcoming talks with the firefighters union. Some 14,000 police have been working without a contract in New York City since June of 2000. Their union is asking for a 23% pay raise over 2 years. Firefighters in Southern California say they've finally contained a destructive wildfire in the mountains east of San Diego. From member station KPBS, Eric Anderson reports.
More than 2 weeks after the Pines Fire roared to life in the drought-stricken mountains, crews have the blaze completely surrounded, and they're hoping for full control by Wednesday. A California National Guard helicopter searching for drug farms in the rural region clipped a utility line, sparking the blaze. More than 3,700 firefighters battled the flames that first raced through a heavily wooded area then ran north to the desert. More than 62,000 acres burned in the fire. The flames also destroyed 37 homes, more than 100 outbuildings, and 169 vehicles. 40 firefighters suffered minor injuries. California Department of Forestry officials say the cost of fighting the wildfire is expected to top $20 million. For NPR News, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
Another airline is offering inexpensive tickets for travel on September 11th. Last week, Spirit Airlines offered free tickets for travel on that day, and they sold out in just hours. Today, National Airlines said it would charge just $1 for travel on September 11th. National offers service to 10 cities around the country from its hub city of Las Vegas. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership, celebrating its 10th anniversary and proudly sponsoring Fast Track for starting and growing businesses.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it, but very few of us know exactly how they do it. And that's where my guest, Olivia Judson, enters the picture. She's a biologist and journalist who specializes in the evolutionary biology of sex. Her articles have appeared in Science, Nature, The Economist, and other publications. Judson says that we don't know the most basic things about this most basic of functions. Think about it. Humans would say sex is copulation, but frogs and most fish would say it's the squirting of eggs and sperm during spawning. Then again, scorpions and salamanders might tell you that sex is packets of sperm deposited on the ground for the female to sit on so they'll explode in her reproductive tract. To address the varied and colorful conflicts that arise in the process of reproduction, Olivia Judson has invented a helpful persona in her new guidebook to the evolutionary biology of sex, Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation.
Dear Dr. Tatiana, I'm a queen bee, and I'm worried. All my lovers leave their genitals inside me and then drop dead. Is this normal? Perplexed in Cloverhill. For your lovers, this is the way the world ends, with a bang, not a whimper. When a male honeybee reaches his climax, he explodes, his genitals ripped from his body with a loud snap. I can see why you find it unnerving. Why does it happen? Alas, Your Majesty, your lovers explode on purpose. By leaving their genitals inside you, they block you up. In doing so, each male hopes you will not be able to mate with another. In other words, his mutilated member is intended as the honeybee version of a chastity belt.
Olivia Judson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The queen bee's question really plunges one into the battle between the sexes right at the beginning of the book. Well, it's really a battle on all fronts.
Yes.
Every man and woman for himself and herself. Do you see this in the likely evolutionary scenario of the honeybee?
I do. I think that the honeybee is a very good example of the sorts of conflicts that arise. The problem is that if a female benefits from mating with more than one male, and in most species we now know, although this is a recent finding, in most species it seems clear that females do benefit a great deal from mating with more than one male. This is a real problem for each of her lovers, because from her point of view, she benefits, she has more and healthier offspring. From his point of view, it's a catastrophe, because her mating with other males means that fewer of her offspring will be his. And in the case of the honeybee, it's particularly dramatic, because each male has, in the first place, a very small chance of mating at all. The fate of most male honeybees is to die virgins. And so those that do have, in fact, nothing to lose by exploding. And the advantage of exploding is that by leaving his member behind, he may be able to prevent the female from mating again. But it's a problem for other males, because obviously they would like to mate as well. And so you would expect to see that the queen does not want to be prevented from mating again, and that other males do not want to be prevented from mating with her. And so, sure enough, the queen is able to clean herself up if she is inclined to. And the males also have now evolved a structure on the tips of their phallus, which allows them to remove the detritus from a previous lover.
Like a scoop?
Yeah, kind of. It's very common. A lot of males have this feature.
This gets us into promiscuity among males and females in the animal world. And the cliche of human sexuality is that men are promiscuous and women are chaste. How does that play itself out in other species?
I think that's complete nonsense. It used to be thought that that was generally true throughout the animal kingdom, that males were philanderers and females were very virtuous and would resist mating and would never, you know, after they'd mated once, particularly in species that store sperm, they would have enough sperm for their whole lives, and that would be that. They would not be interested in sex anymore. Females are, in general, however, much, much more promiscuous than they need to be if fertilizing their eggs were the only aim. And that discovery was not made until the 1980s. And then it wasn't even realized. So it was realized in the 1980s that females were more promiscuous than people thought. And then it was realized that, in fact, promiscuous females benefit from promiscuity, benefit from their behavior. In other words, promiscuous females tend to have more and healthier offspring in pretty much every species that I could find data for.
And what's the correlation there? Why would that be so?
Well, there's a large industry now in the last, even 3 or 4 years. This has been something that scientists have started looking at because it's been impossible to avoid anymore this horrible truth that females gain from promiscuity. And I think that there are a number of possible reasons. There is no single explanation, but there are all sorts of possible reasons, varying from the idea that females are trying to get higher quality mates, that they meet one guy and they have sex with him just to make sure their eggs are fertilized, and then they meet a better guy so they have sex with him too. That's one idea. Another idea is that having sex with different males allows them to have more help. There are some very obvious cases where this is true. In the bronze-winged jacana, which is a water bird that lives in India, the females run a harem where each female will try to have several males to herself. And the males do all of the work of sitting on eggs and feeding the chicks and building the nests. And the female just sort of, you know, has a grand old time.
In other species, do females only mate with males bearing gifts, like the proverbial box of chocolates?
It's very common. It's not always necessary, but it's very common, particularly in insects. And it can be extraordinarily expensive for the male to produce gifts. Males in most species obviously can't just go down the street and buy whatever they think is appropriate. They have evolved to produce gifts of various sorts. For example, they may hunt and bring the female something that they've caught to show that they're good at hunting, or just, you know, to please her. They may secrete something to give her. For example, in many butterflies, the male will secrete a large gift. And these can be very expensive. In the green-veined butterfly, it's 15% of his body weight. And basically, a male can only do this once. Each subsequent gift will be smaller. And females prefer males with large gifts. So in this species, virgins have an advantage.
Now, sperm are a whole story unto themselves in the animal kingdom. What are some interesting examples of incongruous sperm sizes, shapes, and quantities?
Well, these are again, the question that is best understood is what drives sperm number. For example, the splendid fairy wren is a small bird about the size of a human fist, lives in Australia, has a sperm count of about 8 billion per ejaculate. That's a lot more than a human, by at least a factor of 10. And why? Well, it turns out that sperm counts are pretty directly related to female promiscuity, at least in species that copulate. In species that don't copulate, species like sponges that just put their sperm and eggs into the ocean, then it's the sperm numbers and egg numbers are much more similar. But in species where there's copulation, sperm numbers tend to be quite high, particularly if the female is promiscuous. And sure enough, in the splendid fairy wren, the female is promiscuous. Pretty much each female has a husband and a lover, at least one lover, and will be copulating with both. And the sperm count seems to have escalated accordingly as each male tries to make sure that it's his sperm that are being used.
I'm thinking that I'm thinking that one of the great dangers and what you probably have been warned against your whole career as a scientist of natural history is anthropomorphizing. What danger lurks there for us in this conversation?
Well, anthropomorphism is something that I was warned against when I was an undergraduate studying animal behavior, when I was a graduate student studying animal behavior. And it's something that is often, not always, but often frowned upon by academics, at least when discussing biology with the general public. In fact, between themselves, academics anthropomorphize all the time. For example, when a pair of birds has been living together and nesting together for a couple of years and then they split up, it's called divorce. When an insect attempts to force another insect to have sex with him, it's called rape. But this is not considered to be appropriate for discussion with the general public. I actually think that this view is completely wrong. I think that Darwin, for example, in one of his lesser-known but rather radical books, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, he anthropomorphizes to a great extent and argues that animals, just like humans, have emotions, and I'm sure that that's correct. My former PhD supervisor, Bill Hamilton, who was one of the greatest evolutionary biologists of the 20th century, unfortunately now dead, he also anthropomorphized, and in my opinion, led him to some of his greatest insights. I think that the danger with anthropomorphism is in thinking that it's a description, when in fact it's a metaphor. And as a metaphor, it's a very powerful one, I think. I think that it helps the imagination. If you think, well, if I were 3 inches tall and was trying to attract a female and, you know, I've got to avoid being eaten by the frog sitting behind me and all of that, I think it really helps to make the problems that animals face much more vivid and therefore helps you to solve and understand animal behavior better. But the danger is in thinking that there's necessarily conscious thought when you're describing, for example, a praying mantis biting off the head of her lover.
My guest is evolutionary biologist and journalist Olivia Judson. Her science writing has appeared in The Economist, Nature, Science, and other publications. Her new book is a guide to the evolutionary biology of sex. It's called Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Olivia Judson. She's an evolutionary biologist and science writer. Her articles have appeared in such magazines as The Economist, Science, and Nature. She has a new book about the evolutionary biology of sex, written in the persona of a sex advice columnist. It's called Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. One of my favorite letters is from an iguana in your book, and it goes like this. Dear Dr. Tatiana, I'm a marine iguana, and I'm appalled by the behavior of young iguanas today. I keep encountering groups of youths masturbating at me. It's revolting. I'm sure they didn't dare act this way in Darwin's time. How can I make them stop? Disgusted in the Galapagos. Now, I suppose masturbating serves some purpose, at least as far as iguanas go. What would that be?
Well, the iguana story is very curious. It turns out that these marine iguanas, which live in the Galapagos, have a problem. Young males have a problem, which is that females whether they prefer to mate with big males or not, usually do mate with big males because the big males are able to push the little males off. And so you don't have much time if you're a young male iguana. And it turns out that a little bit of masturbation to get yourself ready for sex decreases the length of time you need to complete copulation before. So this prevents or reduces the chance that you will be interrupted This is a, as far as I know, no other species masturbates in order to reduce the chance of being interrupted.
Now, I'm sure you know the old joke. You know what big feet mean, big boots. So what's the correlation in general between the dimensions of males and the dimensions of their private parts in creation?
Well, in general, it's rather disappointing. In many species, males come in a couple of different shapes, a couple of different body shapes, and these shapes are very distinct and discrete, so it's not as if you have a continuum the way you do in humans, from quite small, stocky guys to really big guys or tall, thin guys or whatever. In humans, there's no clear grouping of males. But in many species, that's not the case, and you have males will be one shape or another. And the thing that I love about this is that when you see a male of a particular shape, you know a lot about how he's going to behave. So, for example, in dung beetles, you have males of two shapes in the species that I'm thinking about. You have big males who are very helpful to the their partner. They help the female to collect dung and to provision the nest. And they're also very, if you were to describe them as a human might, you would say that they were being possessive because they don't like to leave the female by herself for very long, and they're very anxious if she is left alone. They come rushing back to the nest and so on. And then you have small males who attempt to copulate with other men's girls. And the small males will sneak into the nest when the big male's not looking. They will sometimes even dig their way into the nest from another side, erupting through the wall. And unfortunately, the big males have much smaller parts than the smaller males do. And it turns out that the reason for this is that the big males are attempting to reduce the chance of another male mating by hanging around and being possessive, whereas the smaller males, because they are almost always mating with a female that has a partner already, they will always be mating with a female who has received sperm, and so they produce relatively more sperm in order to try to bias the sperm competition in their favor. And so in many, many species, small males have larger bits.
Now, one theme of your book is the collision of the sexes, which, being so intense in so many species, sometimes generates horrific outcomes, such as rape and cannibalism. And I do like how your first chapter in this category starts, rule number one, never get eaten during foreplay. what evolutionary purpose does the violence in sex, then, among many species serve?
Well, cannibalism is a particularly curious example. Everybody knows that the praying mantis has a tendency to munch on her lover. But what everybody doesn't know is that quite often this happens even before he's had a chance to mate. From his point of view, this is a fiasco. Obviously, if he's dead, he cannot continue. He cannot pass on any genes. And it's not just the praying mantis who is guilty of this. It's been reported in cannibalism of this kind has been reported in spiders, more than 80 species. It's also been reported, particularly graphically, in some predaceous midges, where the female plunges her proboscis into the male's head, and her spittle turns his innards to soup. So from the male's point of view, this is being cannibalized is incredibly bad news, particularly if it happens before sex. If it happens during sex, he may still have a chance. He may be able to fertilize some eggs. And if it happens after sex, it may also not be too bad. It depends on his particular situation. For example, the Australian redback spider is the only known species where the male actually would like to be cannibalized, and he jumps into the female's jaws and attempts to persuade her to eat him. All the while he is copulating, all the while she is eating, he is copulating, because in spiders the male's genitalia are modified mouthparts, and so she munches on his belly and he reaches under and fits his mouthparts into the appropriate places on her belly. But this is very unusual, and it turns out that the reason that he doesn't mind being cannibalized, in fact, invites it, is that males who are being eaten are allowed to copulate for longer, and therefore they fertilize a higher proportion of eggs. Males who are rejected will be rejected very quickly, and therefore will not actually be able to fertilize many eggs at all. But for most males, they do not wish to be eaten because being eaten, first of all, precludes reproducing with a given female, and it also obviously precludes reproducing again. But from the female's point of view, it may not necessarily be that bad. At first glance, it appears that for a female to eat a male before sex is idiotic. But in fact, if a female is likely to meet many males during the course of her life, as indeed in many spiders she will do, then it doesn't matter if she eats most of them. As long as she doesn't remain a virgin, she's okay. And so sometimes it's not going to be too bad, and it may even occasionally be to her advantage.
Olivia Judson's new book about the evolutionary biology of sex is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
It is nature that's all simply telling us to fall in love. Oh, yes. And that's why birds do it. Bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Let's do it. Mama, let's fall in love. Papa, mosquitoes, heaven forbid, do it. So does every katydid do it. Oh, let's do it. Mama, let's fall in love. The most refined ladybug do it. When a gentleman calls, moth in your rugs, do it. Well, look here, what's the use of balls? Locusts in the tree, do it. Why, even the bees do it. Even over-educated fleas do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at vermontvacation.com. And from Vintage Books, publishers of The Dying Animal, the new paperback by Philip Roth, author of American Pastoral. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Music from a new collection featuring saxophonist Illinois Jacket. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead has a review. Also, we talk about pirates with underwater explorer Barry Clifford. And we continue our conversation about the sex lives of animals and bugs with evolutionary biologist Olivia Judson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's get back to our interview with Olivia Judson. Judson is a biologist and science journalist. Her articles have appeared in The Economist, Nature, Science, and other publications. Her new book is a guide to the evolutionary biology of sex, called Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. In it, Judson writes in the persona of a sex advice columnist, counseling creatures of all kinds on the strange and often violent encounters they have in the process of reproducing. Another common violent occurrence among many species is gang rape and murder, mostly by battering. Is it unintentional, and how do things get out of hand in the animal world?
Well, it's certainly, there are some very, very unpleasant things that go on. For example, the Hawaiian monk seal, which is one of the most endangered species in the seal species in the world, is at the main culprit in killing Hawaiian monk seals is other Hawaiian monk seals, and this occurs when males batter females to death, trying to climb on her together, and it does seem to be an unfortunate byproduct of males wanting to mate with females. It's particularly likely to occur in species where many males are ready to mate, and they're all gathered in a particular place at the same time, and females arrive one at a time. That's when things are most likely to go wrong. And it seems to be a byproduct of the fact that no male gains by not trying to mate with the female as long as he doesn't get injured himself. Obviously, from the female's point of view, again, this is a disaster. In my view, if this is a common occurrence, it quickly puts a selection pressure on the female so that she will learn to avoid dangerous situations, for example. But it's certainly is pretty bad out there sometimes.
Well, in the situations in which females don't readily submit, why don't they submit if it's to their advantage? They're more likely to survive and also to reproduce.
Well, it's a bit of a mystery. In many species, females are raped. There's no other word for it. Why they do not give in and just lie back and think of England is probably because it's worse to lie back and think of England than it is to fight back. And one reason that this might be the case is if having no choice of mates is detrimental. And certainly in fruit flies, for example, females that are allowed to choose their mate do better than females that are assigned one. And so I would guess that usually females have evolved to resist because resisting is better than submission.
Now, here's a provocative quote from your book. True monogamy is one of the most deviant behaviors in biology. So how rare is rare?
It seems to be pretty rare. I combed the literature for examples, proven examples of monogamy, and they are very, very scarce. And I think that the reason is that it's rarely in anybody's advantage to be monogamous, if you are discussing monogamy purely in terms of how many offspring you'll produce, which is how success is measured in evolutionary terms. Monogamy is rarely advantageous for either sex, and so the conditions under which it evolves are peculiar and unusual.
There are some species, though, that do mate for life. You cite vultures.
The black vulture is one of my favorite examples. The black vulture does appear, as far as we know at the moment, it does appear to be monogamous. They have an interesting social system. They nest in pairs and on territories, quite large territories. But it's not simply a lack of opportunity thing, because black vultures are dependent on carcasses, and many vultures will convene at a single carcass. And so there are certainly opportunities for meeting other vultures and having a bit on the side. But it turns out that the black vultures are, well, prudish. They don't like to see sexual behavior in public. And if an inexperienced black vulture attempts to seduce somebody in public, everybody will attack him or her. And so this appears to reinforce the tendency for monogamous behavior. But there are other species that seem to be monogamous. My guess is that many species of shrimp may turn out to be monogamous. There are certainly quite a few that live in stable pairs, but shrimp are less studied than birds, and so we don't know nearly so much about them.
Can we talk about homosexuality then? If a majority of species do break down to male and female, what does evolutionary biology, how does it inform us on the question of human sexuality and homosexuality among our species?
Well, it's often said, particularly among social conservatives, for example, that homosexuality is unnatural, that it occurs only in humans, and it is some weird deviant behavior. There are two things that I'd like to say about that. The first is that whether it's natural or not is irrelevant, because I could find examples of all sorts of behavior that people would find abhorrent. For example, incest is very common in many organisms, but humans believe that close brother-sister incest is a bad idea. So whether it is natural or not is irrelevant. However, it turns out that, in fact, homosexual behavior is very common in the animal world, much more common than people have thought. And the range is extraordinary. The reason that many people assume that homosexuality cannot be something that occurs in nature is because homosexuals, particularly in the West now, homosexuals tend not to have children, and therefore any genes for homosexuality should disappear very quickly. Well, in other organisms, we know almost nothing about the extent to which homosexual behavior is exclusive. Certainly many individuals engage in bisexual behavior. But I would, for the sake of argument, you can say, well, if the behavior is exclusive, so homosexuals never reproduce, and it is fairly common, so you can't just dismiss it as a fluke, then is there any way that the genes could be maintained in the population? And I think that there are ways that they can be maintained. For example, if a gene that leads to homosexuality in one sex leads to very great reproductive success in the other, then you would expect to see a certain proportion of individuals who are homosexual throughout their lives.
Well, one of the standard arguments against human homosexuality, at least a biological one, runs that if it doesn't lead to reproduction, how can it be a genetic trait? But in this case, it leads to reproduction of others. So
that's
you're
right.
Lending a helping hand.
Not necessarily lending a helping hand. It may be that the gene itself is just very beneficial when it is manifested in one sex. It's certainly true that genes are expressed differently in different sexes, very often. And in that case, you might expect to see that there are some genes that produce homosexuality in one sex, but produce some very beneficial trait in the other. A trait that leads to much greater reproductive success, either very great fecundity or very good looks, or, I mean, this is speculation, we don't know for sure, but that would be one mechanism by which genes for exclusive homosexuality could be maintained.
Well, I have to say a lot of the information in the book makes human sex quite pallid in comparison. Did you come away with your own conclusions about deviancy or any species you particularly envy?
Well, it certainly broadened my horizons. I think that that I would like to be reincarnated as a number of species. I think, for example, it would be fascinating to be a dolphin for all sorts of reasons, but particularly because they seem to have such amazing sex drive. I think that would be fascinating. But I think that in general, I mean, human sex may be dull, and in many respects it is, but basically I'm pretty glad to be human.
Olivia Judson, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Olivia Judson's new book is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. Coming up, pirates as we never saw them in Hollywood movies. This is Fresh Air. On January 2, 1678, a fleet of French ships sank in the Caribbean Sea, 100 miles off the coast of Venezuela. 1,200 sailors died, among the many pirates who were hired by the French to rout the Dutch out of the West Indies. This colossal shipwreck decimated the French Navy and also brought together among the survivors a small number of fierce and ambitious pirate captains, whose joint exploits brought on the golden age of piracy on the high seas. The story of this sunken armada is the subject of undersea explorer and treasure hunter Barry Clifford's new book, The Lost Fleet. Clifford is known for his 1984 discovery of the first authenticated pirate shipwreck, the Whydah, a former slave galley commandeered by the pirate captain Black Sam Bellamy, which sank off the coast of Cape Cod in 1717. I asked Barry Clifford to tell me about one of the pirate leaders who survived the French naval catastrophe, Lawrence de Graaf.
De Graaf is perhaps the most interesting of all the pirates to me because he started out in Holland as a slave, was sent to the Canary Islands, and from there he was put on a Spanish galleon and sent to the Caribbean to look for pirates, and he escaped. And from that moment on, he hated the Spanish and wreaked havoc on any Spanish vessel that he could capture. And he became the most successful pirate of all. What's most fascinating about him, and this is what interested me with the Whydah project as well, is that de Graaf was a former slave, and his history seemed to have been swept under the carpet by historians, that in fact he was described as 6 foot tall, blonde-haired and blue-eyed when he was of African origin. And he was elected by a predominantly white crew as captain of a ship. The last thing that 17th and 18th century historians would want would to have a slave rebellion, to be writing about men like Lawrence de Graaf, because indeed, as what happened in Haiti, a slave rebellion could be devastating.
The way you describe him, he didn't sound like the typical Hollywood pirate. He sounded like a real man of honor.
He was a man of honor. And in fact, he, in many instances, emancipated slaves from slave towns. And after capturing ships, he gave captains leave to go ashore and treated his men quite well. And that's why he was elected, because he was the man to get the group through the day. Whereas the Admiral d'Estrée was appointed to his position as admiral, and that's why I think he was despised by his men, because he was a terrible seaman and ended up destroying the whole French fleet. He had no right being the admiral of the fleet whatsoever. That was just the way in French society at that time that you could be appointed admiral of a fleet. Whereas if you were a pirate and you earned the rank of captain, you were elected.
How were the pirates organized on the ship? They elected their captains. Did they also vote on what city they were going to sack next or what ship they were going to attack?
Everything was voted on. And when four or five pirate captains got together, it was the essence of democracy because they had to agree before they took a step forward. So these must have been fascinating meetings. People like Thomas Paine, Captain Kidd, Degremond, and de Graaf trying to decide on what town to sack next and what to do with the prisoners and if to release slaves and if to sell slaves. And I suppose this is the essence of that period, was that once these men infiltrated back into colonial America and the stories and of their success, you know, what effect did that have on colonial America?
Did pirates battle it out with men of war ships on the high seas like we see in movies?
No, indeed they did. And in many cases, I think that they were avoided, that the pirates were a formidable group. You know, they were obviously fighting for their freedom, whereas, you know, a sailor on a Spanish merchant ship or on a Spanish man of war, they didn't quite have the same thing to fight for. So all of the records indicate that indeed, all the way back to the Elizabethan pirates, that they were an extremely formidable force. And what kept them from really dominating the entire region was that they were free spirits. That was tough. You know, the different captains had different ideas. They went their separate ways. But on the times that they were able to come together and raids on places like Campeche and Caracas and Maracaibo, they were devastatingly effective.
I thought they got most of their treasure by sacking cities, by getting off the ship and invading cities on the coast.
Well, you know, in the early 17th century, indeed, the cities were their main targets. Places, as I said, Maracaibo and Veracruz were easy places for them to study and attack, whereas the Spanish treasure fleets would, you know, were very careful about when and they would leave and how they would leave, and they would obviously have great armadas with them. It wasn't as easy for them at this period in time to attack ships, and it was much easier to attack a city. And in many instances, we see were very, very few pirates. For instance, on the attack of Caracas, there were 47 pirates attacked a garrison of over 2,000 Spanish, and the Spanish ended up running. So when
How did they do that? They just look so scary with the eye patch and the cutlasses. I mean, what was their magic weapon?
I think they were scary. I think they were really scary. I think there was real reason to be afraid of these men, and you know, these were the same people who went into the Canadian wilderness. They were frontiersmen who learned to shoot very accurately. And you know, the last thing that they wanted was to end up in a Spanish jail or in a Spanish galley like Lawrence de Graff did. So, and I think that, you know, it was an outlaw subculture. There's no question about that. But these men were free. And I think once they found that they fought very hard to preserve that freedom. When, for example, the ship that I located on Cape Cod, the Whydah, that was a Royal African slave ship. That company was licensed to buy and sell people. A third of the crew of the Whydah, you know, after they captured the Whydah, were former slaves. And so looking back in history, one has to take a close look at the human element here. You know, you're a slave, you escape, where can you go? There was only one place, and that was piracy. And indeed, from our studies, what we believe is that a third of the participants in this period, again known as the Golden Age of Piracy, were men of African origin, escaped slaves.
I thought it was interesting in your book that you write that there are really not many instances in which pirates made people walk the plank, but there is evidence of one instance, and these pirates did it because they read about it in a book.
That's correct. And but there's very little evidence. I mean, there were a few homicidal maniacs that seemed to have, you know, given pirates like Lawrence de Graff a bad name. But in most instances, when a pirate ship approached another vessel, the merchant vessel didn't want to put up a fight because they were afraid what would happen after that. You know, that they would, you know, that they may end up walking the plank. But when a pirate ship did capture a merchant ship, they gave the merchantmen a chance to join the pirates, and many of them did.
I read in your book that many of the coins that you find have a strike down the middle, as if they were going to be divided in half. What's that all about?
Well, what they would do on the coins that we found from the Whydah. And actually, an elderly woman showed me these coins before I had found it several years ago. Her grandfather had claimed to have found them on the beach. But each of the gold coins had a slice in the middle of them. And later, when I found the pirate ship Whydah, we found several gold coins with that same slice. And what we think they were doing was testing the gold to see if it was counterfeit. But indeed, they, with a big gold bar, they would break it into equal pieces. And everyone shared equally in the pirate community, except for the captain, who was voted to get 2 shares, and perhaps the chief gunner, who would get 1.5 shares. But that was all decided by vote. Everyone else shared equally. And once a certain amount of treasure was accumulated, the pirates could break up and go their separate ways. But you couldn't leave the pirate band until that amount had been accumulated or until it was voted on that you could leave.
Barry Clifford, it was a real pleasure talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Barry Clifford's new book is The Lost Fleet. Coming up, a review of a new CD featuring saxophonist Illinois Jacket. This is Fresh Air. In 1942, bandleader Lionel Hampton recorded an up-tempo number called Flying Home, featuring 21-year-old Illinois Jacket. His extroverted tenor saxophone solo on that record made his name in jazz. Jacket brought the same style to the first Jazz at the Philharmonic concert in 1944, setting the tone for that long series' rabble-rousing saxophone style. Around then, he also began recording as a leader. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of blues and ballads Jacket waxed between 1945 and 47.
Memories of You, 1945, as played by Illinois Jacquet, or Jacket, or Jacquet, if you like. He's pronounced it all three ways, so take your pick. Jacquet could always play breathy, melodious tenor like that, but his bread and butter was excitable blues in the vein of Flying Home. There are lots of those on Jumpin' at Apollo, one of Delmark's many good reissues of jazz and blues recorded for Harlem's Apollo label in the 1940s. Jacquet's disc features three hopping medium-sized bands. In two of them, the bottom end is beefed up by baritone saxophone, as if his own barking tenor wasn't enough. Jacquet had the confidence to surround himself with other competitive horn players, like trumpeter Joe Newman and the great Leo Parker on baritone. Here's South Street Special from 1947. Hear rock and roll coming in that beat. Illinois Jacquet had spent some of the war in Los Angeles, where musicians were making a transition from swing to rhythm and blues, getting bands half as big to riff twice as hard. Jacquet's frantic solo style inspired dozens of saxophonists, whose high energy was part of the big bang that shot rock and roll out of R&B. ¶¶ Illinois Jacquet was wise enough to stay ahead of his imitators. He kept upping the ante till that old flying home solo sounded tame. After leaving Lionel Hampton, he joined the extroverted singer Cab Calloway. His shouts and dramatic high notes echo in Jacquet's increasingly wild falsetto register. Here he is on Jacquet Mood, 1945, with a young Charles Mingus on bass. Check out the weird hookup between bass drum and wah-wah brass in the background, like machinery in a wartime factory. Another sound of L.A. in the 40s. Jacquet's influence spread far and wide. 20 years later, his shrieks and honks were basic vocabulary for free jazz saxophonists like Albert Eiler, as well as R&B stars like Junior Walker and King Curtis. That one musician could feed so many styles, swing, blues, R&B, rock and roll, avant-garde, that's pretty amazing. That he came roaring back with a big band in the 1980s and 90s, still playing tenor in a style out of the saxophone's golden age, that wasn't just icing on the cake. That was a whole other layer. That cake will have 80 candles on it come his birthday in October, by the way. He's done a good job so far. Mr. Jacquet, 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 thank you all, sir.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Jumpin' at the Apollo, featuring saxophonist Illinois Jacquet on the Delmark label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. Our engineer is Al Banks, with help from Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Lindley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television, and by Columbia Records and the James Taylor album October Road, which features 12 new performances, available in stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, following the trail of secret aerospace defense programs in post-war Germany and the U.S., we talk about the controversial history of anti-gravity technology with Nick Cook of Jane's Defense Weekly. His book is The Hunt for Zero Point. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.